human chemists to purify them, bottle them, and store them on a shelf. This is what Sol Spiegelman and his colleagues did in America in the 1960s. Then they put the two molecules together in solution, and a fascinating thing happened. In the test tube, the RNA molecules acted as templates for the synthesis of copies of themselves, aided by the presence of the RNA replicase. The machine tools and the blueprints had been extracted and put into cold storage separately from one another. Then, as soon as they were given access to each other, and also to the small molecules needed as raw materials in water, both got back to their old tricks, even though they were no longer in a living cell, but in a test tube. It is but a short step from this to natural selection and evolution in the laboratory. It is just a chemical version of the computer biomorphs. The experimental method is basically to lay out a long row of test tubes, each containing a solution of RNA replicase and also of raw materials, small molecules that can be used for RNA synthesis. Each test tube contains the machine tools and the raw material, but so far it is sitting idle, doing nothing, because it lacks a blueprint to work from. Now a tiny amount of RNA itself is dropped into the first test tube. The replicase apparatus immediately gets to work and manufactures lots of copies of the newly introduced RNA molecules, which spread through the test tube. Now a drop of the solution in the first test tube is removed and put into the second test tube. The process repeats itself in the second test tube, and then a drop is removed and used to seed the third test tube, and so on. Occasionally, because of random copying errors, a slightly different mutant RNA molecule spontaneously arises. If for any reason the new variety is competitively superior to the old one, superior in the sense that, perhaps because of its low stickiness, it gets itself replicated faster or otherwise more effectively, the new variety will obviously spread through the test tube in which it arose, outnumbering the parental type that gave rise to it. Then, when a drop of solution is removed from that test tube to seed the next test tube, it will be the new mutant variety that does the seeding. If we examine the RNAs in a long succession of test tubes, we see what can only be called evolutionary change. Competitively superior varieties of RNA produced at the end of several test tube generations can be bottled and named for future use. One variety, for example, called V2, replicates much more rapidly than normal Q-beta RNA, probably because it is smaller. Unlike Q-beta RNA, it doesn't have to bother to contain the plans for making replicase. Replicase is provided free by the experimenters.
V2 RNA was used as the starting point for an interesting experiment by Leslie Orgel and his colleagues in California, in which they imposed a difficult environment. They added to their test tubes a poison called ethidium bromide, which inhibits the synthesis of RNA. It gums up the works of the machine tools. Orgel and colleagues began with a weak solution of the poison. At first, the rate of synthesis was slowed down by the poison, but after evolving through about 9 test tube transfer generations, a new strain of RNA that was resistant to the poison had been selected. Rate of RNA synthesis was now comparable to that of normal V2 RNA in the absence of poison. Now Orgel and his colleagues doubled the concentration of poison. Again, the rate of RNA replication dropped, but after another 10 or so test tube transfers, a strain of RNA had evolved that was immune even to the higher concentration of poison. Then the concentration of the poison was doubled again. In this way, by successive doublings, they managed to evolve a strain of RNA that could self-replicate in very high concentrations of ethidium bromide, 10 times as concentrated as the poison that had inhibited the original ancestral V2 RNA. They called the new resistant RNA V40. The evolution of V40 from V2 took about 100 test tube transfer generations. Of course, many actual RNA replication generations go on between each test tube transfer. Orgel has also done experiments in which no enzyme was provided. He found that RNA molecules can replicate themselves spontaneously under these conditions, albeit very slowly. They seem to need some other catalyzing substance, such as zinc. This is important because in the early days of life, when replicators first arose, we cannot suppose that there were enzymes around to help them to replicate. There probably was zinc, though. The complementary experiment was carried out a decade ago in the laboratory of the influential German school working on the origin of life under Manfred Eigen. These workers provided replicase and RNA building blocks in the test tube, but they did not seed the solution with RNA. Nevertheless, a particular large RNA molecule evolved spontaneously in the test tube, and the same molecule re-evolved itself again and again in subsequent independent experiments. Careful checking showed that there was no possibility of chance infection by RNA molecules. This is a remarkable result when you consider the statistical improbability of the same large molecule spontaneously arising twice. It is very much more improbable than the spontaneous typing of "methinks it is like a weasel." Like that phrase in our computer model, the particular favored RNA molecule was built up by gradual, cumulative evolution. The variety of RNA produced, repeatedly, in these experiments, was of the same size and structure as the molecules that Spiegelman had produced. But whereas Spiegelman's had evolved by degeneration from naturally occurring larger Q-beta viral RNA, those of the Eigen group had built themselves up from almost nothing. This particular formula is well adapted to an environment consisting of test tubes provided with ready-made replicase. It therefore is converged upon by cumulative selection from two very different starting points. The larger Q-beta RNA molecules are less well adapted to a test tube environment, but better adapted to the environment provided by E. coli cells.
Experiments such as these help us to appreciate the entirely automatic and non-deliberate nature of natural selection. The machines don't know why they make RNA molecules. It is just a byproduct of their shape that they do. And the RNA molecules themselves don't work out a strategy for getting themselves duplicated. Even if they could think, there is no obvious reason why any thinking entity should be motivated to make copies of itself. If I knew how to make copies of myself, I'm not sure that I would give the project high priority in competition with all the other things that I want to do. Why should I? But motivation is irrelevant for molecules. It is just that the structure of the viral RNA happens to be such that it makes cellular machinery churn out copies of itself. And if any entity anywhere in the universe happens to have the property of being good at making more copies of itself, then automatically more and more copies of that entity will obviously come into existence. Not only that, but since they automatically form lineages and are occasionally miscopied, later versions will tend to be better at making copies of themselves than earlier versions, because of the powerful processes of cumulative selection. It is all utterly simple and automatic. It is so predictable as to be almost inevitable.
A successful RNA molecule in a test tube is successful because of some direct, intrinsic property of itself, something analogous to the stickiness of the earlier hypothetical example. But properties like stickiness are rather boring. They are elementary properties of the replicator itself, properties that have a direct effect on its probability of being replicated. What if the replicator has some effect upon something else, which affects something else, which affects something else, which eventually indirectly affects the replicator's chance of being replicated? You can see that if long chains of causes like this existed, the fundamental truism would still hold. Replicators that happen to have what it takes to get replicated would come to predominate in the world, no matter how long and indirect the chain of causal links by which they influence their probability of being replicated. And by the same token, the world will come to be filled with the links in this causal chain. We shall see those links and marvel at them. In modern organisms, we see them all the time. They are eyes and skins and bones and toes and brains and instincts. These things are the tools of DNA replication. They are caused by DNA, in the sense that differences in eyes, skins, bones, instincts, etc. are caused by differences in DNA. They exert an influence over the replication of the DNA that caused them, in that they affect the survival and reproduction of their bodies, which contain that same DNA and whose fate is therefore shared by the DNA. Therefore, the DNA itself exerts an influence over its own replication via the attributes of bodies. DNA can be said to exert power over its own future, and bodies and their organs and behaviour patterns are the instruments of that power.
When we talk about power, we are talking about consequences of replicators that affect their own future, however indirect those consequences might be. It doesn't matter how many links there are in the chain from cause to effect. If the cause is a self-replicating entity, the effect, be it ever so distant and indirect, can be subject to natural selection. I shall summarize the general idea by telling a particular story about beavers. In detail, it is hypothetical, but it certainly cannot be far from the truth. Although nobody has done research upon the development of brain connections in the beaver, they've done this kind of research on other animals, like worms. I'm borrowing the conclusions and applying them to beavers because beavers are more interesting and congenial to many people than worms. A mutant gene in a beaver is just a change in one letter of the billion-letter text, a change in a particular gene, G. As the young beaver grows, the change is copied, together with all the other letters in the text, into all the beaver's cells. In most of the cells, the gene G is not read. Other genes relevant to the workings of the other cell types are. G is read, however, in some cells in the developing brain. It is read and transcribed into RNA copies. The RNA working copies drift around the interior of the cells, and eventually some of them bump into protein-making machines called ribosomes. The protein-making machines read the RNA working plans and turn out new protein molecules to their specification. These protein molecules curl up into a particular shape determined by their own amino acid sequence, which in turn is governed by the DNA code sequence of the gene G. When G mutates, the change makes a crucial difference to the amino acid sequence normally specified by the gene G, and hence to the coiled-up shape of the protein molecule. These slightly altered protein molecules are mass-produced by the protein-making machines inside the developing brain cells. They in turn act as enzymes, machines that manufacture other compounds in the cells, the gene products. The products of the gene G find their way into the membrane surrounding the cell and are involved in the processes whereby the cell makes connections with other cells. Because of the slight alteration in the original DNA plans, the production rate of certain of these membrane compounds is changed. This, in turn, changes the way in which certain developing brain cells connect up with one another. A subtle alteration in the wiring diagram of a particular part of the beaver's brain has occurred, the indirect, indeed far removed, consequence of a change in the DNA text.
Now it happens that this particular part of the beaver's brain, because of its position in the total wiring diagram, is involved in the beaver's dam-building behaviour. Of course, large parts of the brain are involved whenever the beaver builds a dam, but when the G mutation affects this particular part of the brain's wiring diagram, the change has a specific effect on the behaviour. It causes the beaver to hold its head higher in the water while swimming with a log in its jaws. Higher, that is, than a beaver without the mutation. This makes it a little less likely that mud, attached to the log, will wash off during the journey. This increases the stickiness of the log, which in turn means that when the beaver thrusts it into the dam, the log is more likely to stay there. This will tend to apply to all the logs placed by any beaver bearing this particular mutation. The increased stickiness of the logs is a consequence, again a very indirect consequence, of an alteration in the DNA text. The increased stickiness of the logs makes the dam a sounder structure, less likely to break up. This in turn increases the size of the lake created by the dam, which makes the lodge in the center of the lake more secure against predators. This tends to increase the number of offspring successfully reared by the beaver. If we look at the whole population of beavers, those that possess the mutated gene will, on average, tend therefore to rear more offspring than those not possessing the mutated gene. Those offspring will tend to inherit archive copies of the self-same altered gene from their parents. Therefore, in the population, this form of the gene will become more numerous as the generations go by. Eventually, it will become the norm and will no longer deserve the title mutant. Beaver dams in general will have improved another notch.
The fact that this particular story is hypothetical and that the details may be wrong is irrelevant. The beaver dam evolved by natural selection, and therefore what happened cannot be very different except in practical details from the story you have heard. The general implications of this view of life are explained and elaborated in my book, The Extended Phenotype, and I shan't repeat the arguments here. You'll notice that in this hypothetical story, there were no fewer than 11 links in the causal chain linking altered gene to improved survival. In real life, there might be even more. Every one of those links, whether it is an effect on the chemistry inside a cell, a later effect on how brain cells wire themselves together, or an even later effect on behavior, or a final effect on lake size, is correctly regarded as caused by a change in the DNA. It wouldn't matter if there were 111 links. Any effect that a change in a gene has on its own replication probability is fair game for natural selection. It is all perfectly simple and delightfully automatic and unpremeditated. Something like it is well-nigh inevitable once the fundamental ingredients of cumulative selection, replication, error, and power, have come into existence in the first place. But how did this happen? How did they come into existence on Earth before life was there? We shall see how this difficult question might be answered in the next chapter. Chapter 6. Origins and Miracles. Chance, luck, coincidence, miracle. One of the main topics of this chapter is miracles and what we mean by them. My thesis will be that events that we commonly call miracles are not supernatural, but are part of a spectrum of more or less improbable natural events. A miracle, in other words, if it occurs at all, is a tremendous stroke of luck. Events don't fall neatly into natural events versus miracles. There are some would-be events that are too improbable to be contemplated, but we don't know this until we've done a calculation. And to do the calculation, we must know how much time was available, more generally, how many opportunities were available for the event to occur. Given infinite time or infinite opportunities, anything is possible. The large numbers proverbially furnished by astronomy and the large time spans characteristic of geology combined to turn topsy-turvy our everyday estimates of what is expected and what is miraculous. I shall build up to this point using a specific example, which is the other main theme of this chapter. This example is the problem of how life originated on Earth. To make the point clearly, I shall arbitrarily concentrate on one particular theory of the origin of life, although any one of the modern theories would have served the purpose. We can accept a certain amount of luck in our explanations, but not too much. The question is, how much? The immensity of geological time entitles us to postulate more improbable coincidences than a court of law would allow, but even so, there are limits. Cumulative selection is the key to all our modern explanations of life. It strings a series of acceptably lucky events, random mutations, together in a non-random sequence so that, at the end of the sequence, the finished product carries the illusion of being very, very lucky indeed, far too improbable to have come about by chance alone, even given a time span millions of times longer than the age of the universe so far. Cumulative selection is the key, but it had to get started, and we cannot escape the need to postulate a single step, chance event, in the origin of cumulative selection itself. And that vital first step was a difficult one because, at its heart, there lies what seems to be a paradox. The replication processes that we know seem to need complicated machinery to work. In the presence of a replicase machine tool, fragments of RNA will evolve repeatedly and convergently towards the same endpoint, an endpoint whose probability seems vanishingly small until you reflect on the power of cumulative selection. But we have to assist this cumulative selection to get started. It won't go unless we provide a catalyst, such as the replicase machine tool of the previous chapter. And that catalyst, it seems, is unlikely to come into existence spontaneously, except under the direction of other RNA molecules. DNA molecules replicate in the complicated machinery of the cell, and written words replicate in Xerox machines, but neither seem capable of spontaneous replication in the absence of their supporting machinery. A Xerox machine is capable of copying its own blueprints, but it is not capable of springing spontaneously into existence. Biomorphs readily replicate in the environment provided by a suitably written computer program, but they can't write their own program or build a computer to run it. The theory of the blind watchmaker is extremely powerful given that we are allowed to assume replication and hence cumulative selection. But if replication needs complex machinery, since the only way we know for complex machinery ultimately to come into existence is cumulative selection, we have a problem.
Certainly modern cellular machinery, the apparatus of DNA replication and protein synthesis, has all the hallmarks of a highly evolved, specially fashioned machine. We have seen how staggeringly impressive it is as an accurate data storage device. At its own level of ultra-miniaturization, it is of the same order of elaborateness and complexity of design as the human eye is at the grosser level. All who have given thought to the matter agree that an apparatus as complex as the human eye could not possibly come into existence through single-step selection. Unfortunately, the same seems to be true of at least parts of the apparatus of cellular machinery whereby DNA replicates itself, and this applies not just to the cells of advanced creatures like ourselves and amoebas, but also to relatively more primitive creatures like bacteria and blue-green algae. So, cumulative selection can manufacture complexity, while single-step selection cannot. But cumulative selection cannot work unless there is some minimal machinery of replication and replicator power, and the only machinery of replication that we know seems too complicated to have come into existence by means of anything less than many generations of cumulative selection. Some people see this as a fundamental flaw in the whole theory of the blind watchmaker. They see it as the ultimate proof that there must originally have been a designer, not a blind watchmaker, but a far-sighted, supernatural watchmaker. Maybe, it is argued, the creator does not control the day-to-day succession of evolutionary events. Maybe he did not frame the tiger and the lamb. Maybe he did not make a tree, but he did set up the original machinery of replication and replicator power, the original machinery of DNA and protein that made cumulative selection and hence all of evolution possible.
This is a transparently feeble argument. Indeed, it is obviously self-defeating. Organized complexity is the thing that we are having difficulty in explaining. Once we are allowed simply to postulate organized complexity, if only the organized complexity of the DNA protein replicating engine, it is relatively easy to invoke it as a generator of yet more organized complexity. That, indeed, is what most of this book is about. But of course, any god capable of intelligently designing something as complex as the DNA protein replicating machine must have been at least as complex and organized as that machine itself. Far more so if we suppose him additionally capable of such advanced functions as listening to prayers and forgiving sins. To explain the origin of the DNA protein machine by invoking a supernatural designer is to explain precisely nothing, for it leaves unexplained the origin of the designer. You have to say something like, God was always there. And if you allow yourself that kind of lazy way out, you might as well just say DNA was always there or life was always there and be done with it.
The more we can get away from miracles, major improbabilities, fantastic coincidences, large chance events, and the more thoroughly we can break large chance events up into a cumulative series of small chance events, the more satisfying to rational minds our explanations will be. But in this chapter, we are asking how improbable, how miraculous, a single event we are allowed to postulate. What is the largest single event of sheer naked coincidence, sheer unadulterated miraculous luck that we are allowed to get away with in our theories and still say that we have a satisfactory explanation of life? In order for a monkey to write, "Methinks it is like a weasel," by chance, it needs a very large amount of luck, but it is still measurable. We calculated the odds against it as about 10,000 million 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 million, 10 to the power 40, to 1 against. Nobody can really comprehend or imagine such a large number, and we just think of this degree of improbability as synonymous with impossible. But although we can't comprehend these levels of improbability in our minds, we shouldn't just run away from them in terror. The number 10 to the power 40 may be very large, but we can still write it down and we can still use it in calculations. There are, after all, even larger numbers. 10 to the power 46, for instance, is not just larger. You must add 10 to the power 40 to itself a million times in order to obtain 10 to the power 46. What if we could somehow muster a gang of 10 to the power 46 monkeys, each with its own typewriter? Why, lo and behold, one of them would solemnly type, "Methinks it is like a weasel," and another would almost certainly type, "I think, therefore I am." The problem is, of course, that we couldn't assemble that many monkeys. If all the matter in the universe were turned into monkey flesh, we still couldn't get enough monkeys. The miracle of a monkey typing, "Methinks it is like a weasel," is quantitatively too great, measurably too great, for us to admit it to our theories about what actually happens. But we couldn't know this until we sat down and did the calculation.
So there are some levels of sheer luck, not only too great for puny human imaginations, but too great to be allowed in our hard-headed calculations about the origin of life. But to repeat the question, how great a level of luck, how much of a miracle are we allowed to postulate? Don't let's run away from this question just because large numbers are involved. It is a perfectly valid question, and we can at least write down what we would need to know in order to calculate the answer. Now here's a fascinating thought. The answer to our question of how much luck we are allowed to postulate depends upon whether our planet is the only one that has life, or whether life abounds all around the universe. The one thing we know for certain is that life has arisen once here on this very planet. But we have no idea at all whether there is life anywhere else in the universe. It is entirely possible that there isn't. Some people have calculated that there must be life elsewhere on the following grounds. I won't point out the fallacy until afterwards. There are probably at least 10 to the power 20, that is 100 billion billion, roughly suitable planets in the universe. We know that life has arisen here, so it can't be all that improbable. Therefore, it is almost inescapable that at least some among all those billions of billions of other planets have life. The flaw in the argument lies in the inference that, because life has arisen here, it can't be too terribly improbable. You will notice that this inference contains the built-in assumption that whatever went on Earth is likely to have gone on elsewhere in the universe, and this begs the whole question. In other words, that kind of statistical argument, that there must be life elsewhere in the universe because there is life here, builds in, as an assumption, what it is setting out to prove. This doesn't mean that the conclusion that life exists all around the universe is necessarily wrong. My guess is that it is probably right. It simply means that that particular argument that led up to it is no argument at all. It is just an assumption. Let us, for the sake of discussion, entertain the alternative assumption that life has arisen only once, ever, and that was here on Earth. It is tempting to object to this assumption on the following emotional grounds. Isn't there something terribly medieval about it? Doesn't it recall the time when the church taught that our Earth was the center of the universe and the stars just little pinpricks of light set in the sky for our delight? Or even more absurdly presumptuous, that the stars go out of their way to exert astrological influences on our little lives? How very conceited to assume that, out of all the billions and billions of planets in the universe, our own little backwater of a world, in our own local backwater of a solar system, in our own local backwater of a galaxy, should have been singled out for life? Why, for goodness sake, should it have been our planet? I'm genuinely sorry, for I'm heartily thankful that we have escaped from the small-mindedness of the medieval church, and I despise modern astrologers, but I'm afraid that the rhetoric about backwaters in the previous paragraph is just empty rhetoric. It is entirely possible that our backwater of a planet is literally the only one that has ever borne life. The point is that if there were only one planet that had ever borne life, then it would have to be our planet, for the very good reason that we are here discussing the question. If the origin of life is such an improbable event that it happened on only one planet in the universe, then our planet has to be that planet. So we can't use the fact that Earth has life to conclude that life must be probable enough to have arisen on another planet. Such an argument would be circular. We have to have some independent arguments about how easy or difficult it is for life to originate on a planet before we can even begin to answer the question of how many other planets in the universe have life. But that isn't the question we set out with. Our question was, how much luck are we allowed to assume in a theory of the origin of life on Earth? I said that the answer depends upon whether life has arisen only once or many times. Begin by giving a name to the probability, however low it is, that life will originate on any randomly designated planet of some particular type. Call this number the spontaneous generation probability, or SGP. It is the SGP that we shall arrive at if we sit down with our chemistry textbooks or strike sparks through plausible mixtures of atmospheric gases in our laboratory and calculate the odds of replicating molecules springing spontaneously into existence in a typical planetary atmosphere. Suppose that our best guess of the SGP is some very, very small number, say 1 in a billion. This is obviously such a small probability that we haven't the faintest hope of duplicating such a fantastically lucky, miraculous event as the origin of life in our laboratory experiments. Yet, if we assume, as we are perfectly entitled to do for the sake of argument, that life has originated only once in the universe, it follows that we are allowed to postulate a very large amount of luck in a theory, because there are so many planets in the universe where life could have originated. If, as one estimate has it, there are 100 billion planets, this is 100 billion times greater than even the very low SGP that we postulated. To conclude this argument, the maximum amount of luck that we are allowed to assume before we reject a particular theory of the origin of life has odds of 1 in n, where n is the number of suitable planets in the universe. There's a lot hidden in that word suitable, but let us put an upper limit of 1 in 100 billion for the maximum amount of luck that this argument entitles us to assume.
Think about what this means. We go to a chemist and say, get out your textbooks and your calculating machine, sharpen your pencil and your wits, fill your head with formulae and your flasks with methane and ammonia and hydrogen and carbon dioxide and all the other gases that a primeval non-living planet can be expected to have. Cook them all up together, pass strokes of lightning through your simulated atmospheres and strokes of inspiration through your brain. Bring all your clever chemist's methods to bear and give us your best chemist's estimate of the probability that a typical planet will spontaneously generate a self-replicating molecule. Or to put it another way, how long would we have to wait before random chemical events on the planet, random thermal jostling of atoms and molecules, resulted in a self-replicating molecule? Chemists don't know the answer to this question. Most modern chemists would probably say that we'd have to wait a long time by the standards of a human lifetime, but perhaps not all that long by the standards of cosmological time. The fossil history of Earth suggests that we have about a billion years, one eon, to use a convenient modern definition, to play with. For this is roughly the time that elapsed between the origin of the Earth about 4.5 billion years ago and the era of the first fossil organisms. But the point of our numbers of planets argument is that even if the chemist said that we'd have to wait for a miracle, have to wait a billion billion years, far longer than the universe has existed, we can still accept this verdict with equanimity. There are probably more than a billion billion available planets in the universe. If each of them lasts as long as Earth, that gives us about a billion 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 planet years to play with. That will do nicely. A miracle is translated into practical politics by a multiplication sum.
There is a concealed assumption in this argument. Well, actually, there are lots, but there's one in particular that I want to talk about. This is that once life, i.e. replicators and cumulative selection, originates at all, it always advances to the point where its creatures evolve enough intelligence to speculate about their origins. If this is not so, our estimate of the amount of luck that we are allowed to postulate must be reduced accordingly. To be more precise, the maximum odds against the origin of life on any one planet that our theories are allowed to postulate is the number of available planets in the universe divided by the odds that life, once started, will evolve sufficient intelligence to speculate about its own origins. It may seem a little strange that sufficient intelligence to speculate about its own origins is a relevant variable. To understand why it is, consider an alternative assumption. Suppose that the origin of life was quite a probable event, but the subsequent evolution of intelligence was exceedingly improbable, demanding a huge stroke of luck. Suppose the origin of intelligence is so improbable that it has happened on only one planet in the universe, even though life has started on many planets. Then, since we know we are intelligent enough to discuss the question, we know that Earth must be that one planet. Now suppose that the origin of life and the origin of intelligence, given that life is there, are both highly improbable events. Then the probability of any one planet, such as Earth, enjoying both strokes of luck is the product of the two low probabilities, and this is a far smaller probability.
It is as though, in our theory of how we came to exist, we are allowed to postulate a certain ration of luck. This ration has, as its upper limit, the number of eligible planets in the universe. Given our ration of luck, we can then spend it as a limited commodity over the course of our explanation of our own existence. If we use up almost all our ration of luck in our theory of how life gets started on a planet in the first place, then we are allowed to postulate very little more luck in subsequent parts of our theory in, say, the cumulative evolution of brains and intelligence. If we don't use up all our ration of luck in our theory of the origin of life, we have some left over to spend on our theories of subsequent evolution after cumulative selection has got going. If we want to use up most of our ration of luck in our theory of the origin of intelligence, then we haven't much left over to spend on our theory of the origin of life. We must come up with a theory that makes the origin of life almost inevitable. Alternatively, if we don't need our whole luck ration for these two stages of our theory, we can, in effect, use the surplus to postulate life elsewhere in the universe.
My personal feeling is that once cumulative selection has got itself properly started, we need to postulate only a relatively small amount of luck in the subsequent evolution of life and intelligence. Cumulative selection, once it has begun, seems to me powerful enough to make the evolution of intelligence probable, if not inevitable. This means that we can, if we want to, spend virtually our entire ration of postulatable luck in one big throw in our theory of the origin of life on a planet. Therefore, we have at our disposal, if we want to use it, odds of 1 in 100 billion billion as an upper limit, or 1 in however many available planets we think there are, to spend in our theory of the origin of life. This is the maximum amount of luck we are allowed to postulate in our theory. Suppose we want to suggest, for instance, that life began when both DNA and its protein-based replication machinery spontaneously chance to come into existence. We can allow ourselves the luxury of such an extravagant theory, provided that the odds against this coincidence occurring on a planet do not exceed 100 billion billion to 1.
This allowance may seem large. It is probably ample to accommodate the spontaneous arising of DNA or RNA. But it is nowhere near enough to enable us to do without cumulative selection altogether. The odds against assembling a well-designed body that flies as well as a swift, or swims as well as a dolphin, or sees as well as a falcon, in a single blow of luck, single-step selection, are stupendously greater than the number of atoms in the universe, let alone the number of planets. No, it is certain that we are going to need a hefty measure of cumulative selection in our explanations of life.
But although we are entitled, in our theory of the origin of life, to spend a maximum ration of luck amounting perhaps to odds of 100 billion billion to 1 against, my hunch is that we aren't going to need more than a small fraction of that ration. The origin of life on a planet can be a very probable event indeed by our everyday standards, or indeed by the standards of the chemistry laboratory, and still be sufficiently probable to have occurred not just once, but many times all over the universe. We can regard the statistical argument about numbers of planets as an argument of last resort. At the end of the chapter, I shall make the paradoxical point that the theory we are looking for may actually need to seem improbable, even miraculous, to our subjective judgment, because of the way our subjective judgment has been made. Nevertheless, it is still sensible for us to begin by seeking that theory of the origin of life with the least degree of improbability. If the theory that DNA and its copying machinery arose spontaneously is so improbable that it obliges us to assume that life is very rare in the universe and may even be unique to Earth, our first resort is to try to find a more probable theory. So, can we come up with any speculations about relatively probable ways in which cumulative selection might have got its start? The word speculate has pejorative overtones, but these are quite uncalled for here. We can hope for nothing more than speculation when the events we are talking about took place 4 billion years ago and took place, moreover, in a world that must have been radically different from that which we know today. For instance, there almost certainly was no free oxygen in the atmosphere. Though the chemistry of the world may have changed, the laws of chemistry have not changed. That is why they are called laws, and modern chemists know enough about those laws to make some well-informed speculations, speculations that have to pass rigorous tests of plausibility imposed by the laws. You can't just speculate wildly and irresponsibly, allowing your imagination to run riot in the manner of such unsatisfying space fiction panaceas as hyperdrives, time warps, and infinite improbability drives. Of all possible speculations about the origin of life, most run foul of the laws of chemistry and can be ruled out, even if we make full use of our statistical fallback argument about numbers of planets. Careful, selective speculation is therefore a constructive exercise. But you do have to be a chemist to do it. I am a biologist, not a chemist, and I must rely on chemists to get their sums right. Different chemists prefer different pet theories, and there is no shortage of theories. I could attempt to lay all these theories before you impartially. That would be the proper thing to do in a student textbook. This isn't a student textbook. The basic idea of the blind watchmaker is that we don't need to postulate a designer in order to understand life or anything else in the universe. We are here concerned with the kind of solution that must be found because of the kind of problem we are faced with. I think that this is best explained not by looking at lots of particular theories, but by looking at one as an example of how the basic problem, how cumulative selection got its start, might be solved.
Now, which theory to choose as the representative sample? Most textbooks give greatest weight to the family of theories based on an organic primeval soup. It seems probable that the atmosphere of Earth before the coming of life was like that of other planets, which are still lifeless. There was no oxygen, plenty of hydrogen and water, carbon dioxide, very likely ammonia, methane, and other simple organic gases. Chemists know that oxygen-free climates like this tend to foster the spontaneous synthesis of organic compounds. They've set up in flasks miniature reconstructions of conditions on the early Earth. They've passed through the flasks electric sparks simulating lightning and ultraviolet light, which would have been much stronger before the Earth had an ozone layer shielding it from the sun's rays. The results of these experiments have been exciting. Organic molecules, some of them of the same general types as are normally only found in living things, have spontaneously assembled themselves in these flasks. Neither DNA nor RNA has appeared, but the building blocks of these large molecules, called purines and pyrimidines, have. So have the building blocks of proteins, amino acids. The missing link for this class of theories is still the origin of replication. The building blocks haven't come together to form a self-replicating chain like RNA. Maybe one day they will.
But in any case, the organic primeval soup theory is not the one I have chosen for my illustration of the kind of solution that we must look for. I did choose it in my first book, The Selfish Gene, so I thought that here I would fly a kite for a somewhat less fashionable theory, although it recently has started gaining ground, which seems to me to have at least a sporting chance of being right. Its audacity is appealing, and it does illustrate well the properties that any satisfying theory of the origin of life must have. This is the inorganic mineral theory of the Glasgow chemist Graham Cairns-Smith, first proposed in the 1960s and since developed and elaborated in three books, the latest of which, Seven Clues to the Origin of Life, treats the origin of life as a mystery needing a Sherlock Holmes solution. Cairns-Smith's view of the DNA protein machinery is that it probably came into existence relatively recently, perhaps as recently as 3 billion years ago. Before that, there were many generations of cumulative selection based upon some quite different replicating entities. Once DNA was there, it proved to be so much more efficient as a replicator and so much more powerful in its effects on its own replication that the original replication system that spawned it was cast off and forgotten. The modern DNA machinery, according to this view, is a latecomer, a recent usurper of the role of fundamental replicator, having taken over that role from an earlier and cruder replicator. There may even have been a whole series of such usurpations, but the original replication process must have been sufficiently simple to have come about through what I have dubbed single-step selection.
Chemists divide their subject into two main branches, organic and inorganic. Organic chemistry is the chemistry of one particular element, carbon. Inorganic chemistry is all the rest. Carbon is important and deserves to have its own private branch of chemistry, partly because life chemistry is all carbon chemistry, and partly because those same properties that make carbon chemistry suitable for life also make it suitable for industrial processes, such as those of the plastics industry. The essential property of carbon atoms that makes them so suitable for life and for industrial synthetics is that they join together to form a limitless repertoire of different kinds of very large molecules. Another element that has some of these same properties is silicon. Although the chemistry of modern earthbound life is all carbon chemistry, this may not be true all over the universe, and it may not always have been true on this Earth. Cairns-Smith believes that the original life on this planet was based on self-replicating inorganic crystals such as silicates. If this is true, organic replicators and eventually DNA must later have taken over or usurped the role. He gives some arguments for the general plausibility of this idea of takeover. An arch of stones, for instance, is a stable structure capable of standing for many years even if there is no cement to bind it. Building a complex structure by evolution is like trying to build a mortarless arch if you are allowed to touch only one stone at a time. Think about the task naively and it can't be done. The arch will stand once the last stone is in place, but the intermediate stages are unstable. It's quite easy to build the arch, however, if you are allowed to subtract stones as well as add them. Start by building a solid heap of stones, Then build the arch resting on top of this solid foundation. Then, when the arch is all in position, including the vital keystone at the top, carefully remove the supporting stones and, with a modicum of luck, the arch will remain standing. Stonehenge is incomprehensible until we realize that the builders used some kind of scaffolding, or perhaps ramps of earth, which are no longer there. We can see only the end product and have to infer the vanished scaffolding. Similarly, DNA and protein are two pillars of a stable and elegant arch which persists once all its parts simultaneously exist. It is hard to imagine it arising by any step-by-step process unless some earlier scaffolding has completely disappeared. That scaffolding must itself have been built by an earlier form of cumulative selection at whose nature we can only guess. But it must have been based upon replicating entities with power over their own future. Cairn Smith's guess is that the original replicators were crystals of inorganic materials such as those found in clays and muds. A crystal is just a large, orderly array of atoms or molecules in the solid state. Because of properties that we can think of as their shape, atoms and small molecules tend naturally to pack themselves together in a fixed and orderly manner. It is almost as though they want to slot together in a particular way, but this illusion is just an inadvertent consequence of their properties. Their preferred way of slotting together shapes the whole crystal. It also means that even in a large crystal such as a diamond, any part of the crystal is exactly the same as any other part, except where there are flaws. If we could shrink ourselves to the atomic scale, we would see almost endless rows of atoms stretching to the horizon in straight lines, galleries of geometric repetition.
Since it is replication we are interested in, the first thing we must know is, can crystals replicate their structure? Crystals are made of myriads of layers of atoms or equivalent, and each layer builds upon the layer below. Atoms, or ions, the difference needn't concern us, float around free in solution, but if they happen to encounter a crystal, they have a natural tendency to slot into position on the surface of the crystal. A solution of common salt contains sodium ions and chloride ions, jostling about in a more or less chaotic fashion. A crystal of common salt is a packed, orderly array of sodium ions alternating with chloride ions at right angles to one another. When ions floating in the water happen to bump into the hard surface of the crystal, they tend to stick. And they stick in just the right places to cause a new layer to be added to the crystal, just like the layer below. So once a crystal gets started, it grows, each layer being the same as the layer below. Sometimes crystals spontaneously start to form in solution. At other times they have to be seeded, either by particles of dust or by small crystals dropped in from elsewhere. Cairn Smith invites us to perform the following experiment. Dissolve a large quantity of photographer's hypo fixer in very hot water. Then let the solution cool down, being careful not to let any dust drop in. The solution is now supersaturated, ready and waiting to make crystals, but with no seed crystals to start the process going. The following passage is from Cairn Smith's Seven Clues to the Origin of Life.
Carefully take the lid off the beaker, drop one tiny piece of hypocrystal onto the surface of the solution, and watch amazed at what happens. Your crystal grows visibly. It breaks up from time to time and the pieces also grow. Soon your beaker is crowded with crystals, some several centimetres long. Then, after a few minutes, it all stops. The magic solution has lost its power, although if you want another performance, just reheat and recool the beaker. To be supersaturated means to have more dissolved than there ought to be. The cold, supersaturated solution almost literally did not know what to do. It had to be told by adding a piece of crystal that already had its units, billions and billions of them, packed together in the way that is characteristic for hypocrystals. The solution had to be seeded.
Some chemical substances have the potential to crystallize in two alternative ways. Graphite and diamonds, for instance, are both crystals of pure carbon. Their atoms are identical. The two substances differ from each other only in the geometric patterns with which the carbon atoms are packed. In diamonds, the carbon atoms are packed in a tetrahedral pattern which is extremely stable. This is why diamonds are so hard. In graphite, the carbon atoms are arranged in flat hexagons layered on top of each other. The bonding between layers is weak, and they therefore slide over each other, which is why graphite feels slippery and is used as a lubricant. Unfortunately, you can't crystallize diamonds out of a solution by seeding them, as you can with hypo. If you could, you'd be rich. No, on second thoughts, you wouldn't, because any fool could do the same.
Now suppose we have a supersaturated solution of some substance, like hypo, in that it was eager to crystallize out of solution, and like carbon, in that it was capable of crystallizing in either of two ways. One way might be somewhat like graphite, with the atoms arranged in layers, leading to little flat crystals, while the other way gives chunky diamond-shaped crystals. Now we simultaneously drop into our supersaturated solution a tiny flat crystal and a tiny chunky crystal. We can describe what would happen in an elaboration of Cairns-Smith's description of his hypo experiment. You watch amazed at what happens. Your two crystals grow visibly. They break up from time to time, and the pieces also grow. Flat crystals give rise to a population of flat crystals. Chunky crystals give rise to a population of chunky crystals. If there is any tendency for one type of crystal to grow and split more quickly than the other, we shall have a simple kind of natural selection. But the process still lacks a vital ingredient in order to give rise to evolutionary change. That ingredient is hereditary variation or something equivalent to it. Instead of just two types of crystal, there must be a whole range of minor variants that form lineages of like shape and that sometimes mutate to produce new shapes. Do real crystals have something corresponding to hereditary mutation? Clays and muds and rocks are made of tiny crystals. They are abundant on Earth and probably always have been. When you look at the surface of some types of clay and other minerals with a scanning electron microscope, you see an amazing and beautiful sight. Crystals grow like rows of flowers or cactuses, gardens of inorganic rose petals, tiny spirals like cross-sections of succulent plants, bristling organ pipes, complicated angular shapes folded as if in miniature crystalline origami, writhing growths like worm casts or squeezed toothpaste. The ordered patterns become even more striking at greater levels of magnification. At levels that betray the actual position of atoms, the surface of a crystal is seen to have all the regularity of a machine-woven piece of herringbone tweed. But, and here is the vital point, there are flaws. Right in the middle of an expanse of orderly herringbone, there can be a patch identical to the rest, except that it is twisted round at a different angle, so that the weave goes off in another direction. Or the weave may lie in the same direction, but each row has slipped half a row to one side. Nearly all naturally occurring crystals have flaws, and once a flaw has appeared, it tends to be copied as subsequent layers of crystal encrust themselves on top of it.
Flaws can occur anywhere over the surface of a crystal. If you like thinking about capacity for information storage, I do, you can imagine the enormous number of different patterns of flaws that could be created over the surface of a crystal. All those calculations about packing the New Testament into the DNA of a single bacterium could be done just as impressively for almost any crystal. What DNA has over normal crystals is a means by which its information can be read. Leaving aside the problem of readout, you could easily devise an arbitrary code whereby flaws in the atomic structure of the crystal denote binary numbers. You could then pack several New Testaments into a mineral crystal the size of a pin's head. On a larger scale, This is essentially how music information is stored on the surface of a compact disc. The music notes are converted by computer into binary numbers. A laser is used to etch a pattern of tiny flaws in the otherwise glassy smooth surface of the disc. Each little hole etched